Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
Now we have these long lines. Long lines, go forward and back. Four steps in. And back. Beautiful. Wow.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And that's the sound of caller Luke Donforth teaching steps at a contra dance put on by the Mad Robin Callers Collective at the First Congregational Church in Burlington last weekend. Contra dance is a popular activity in this part of the country, and it resonates with dancers of all ages. But if you're not steeped in contra or other forms of country dancing, you might not know its wild history here. So today we are going to fill you in, and we're joined by Richard Neville, a New Hampshire author, filmmaker, and contra dance enthusiast. His book on the subject is called A Time to Dance, American Country Dancing from Hornpipes to Hot Hash. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jane.
We are also joined by a dancer, dance organizer, and starting just recently, a dance caller, Dana Dwinell Yardley, who lives in Montpelier. Hello, Dana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Richard, maybe you can start us out with some definitions so we're all on the same dance floor here. I guess all contra is country dancing, but not all country dancing is contra dancing. Can you explain the differences and what's what?
Yeah, country dancing is the whole, everything. Contra dancing, big circle dancing in the South, Western square dancing, maybe some other ones that I can't draw into my brain right at the moment. But country dancing is the basic, and it has a lot of different forms depending on where it is and who's doing it.
And around here, contra dancing is the big one?
Contra dancing is the big one in New England, for sure.
All right. So I will admit here that I have never been to a contra dance.
Oh, that's
and
okay.
I know, please don't give me the hate stares. But Dana, can you explain it? Can you explain contra dancing?
Sure. So if you think about a square dance where you're dancing with your partner and three other couples, you can imagine that. Maybe some folks have done that in grade school. Think about that, but it happens in long lines up and down the hall. So you and your partner are dancing with one other couple at a time. You'll do a series of moves, and then you'll pass through and go on to a new couple and dance with them. So you're really dancing with the whole hall in an evening up the line and back down the line. It's done to live music, live calling. The whole dance is co-created there by the musicians and callers and performers in the hall.
Okay, so you've explained a little about contra dancing. Dana, can you explain its appeal?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Contra dancing is the most fun. I often will be feeling maybe tired or grumpy, and I'm like, should I really go out dancing? And then I go dancing, and it is guaranteed to put me in a better mood. It's a very accessible dance form. You really don't need anything to get started. You don't need fancy shoes. You don't need lessons. You don't need a partner. You can just show up at the hall. All the dances are taught. You really are just walking with other folks to music. And there's this really sense of shared joy and delight that happens when you're doing all the same moves in a hall full of people doing this all together. And there's this synergy that happens between the band and the dancers and the caller that just, joy is the best way to describe it.
Richard, what about for you? What would you say the appeal is, and how did you get into it?
Oh, well, that's a long story, which I won't totally bore you with, but somebody took me to a dance because they thought I would like it, and their dad was one of the musicians who turned out to be a guy named Bob McQuillan, who was a legend in contra dance music. Everybody knows who he was. He passed away several years ago at age 92, and he was still playing for dances. Anyway, his daughter dragged me to a dance in Francistown, New Hampshire, and that was it. I was hooked immediately. It's the music, really. It's the music. It's that it's live and that it's good. And the better it is, the better the dance. That's the way I look at it.
And why not just go hear the music and tap your toes? What is it about?
Well, that's good, too.
Yeah.
My wife does that a lot because she's a little shy. But, yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to do the dancing, but it is magical when you do it and it's really working. There's nothing like it.
We got a note about that actually from Chip in South Stratford, who says you can't separate the music from the dancing.
Right.
But this living tradition hasn't fossilized, as played by hot new dance bands, tunes from before the American Revolution can excite the dancers as much as contemporary compositions.
Absolutely.
Where we live in Vermont is pretty close to the heart of this tradition, but influences on both the dancing and the music come from the Southern Appalachians, from Scotland and Ireland, from Quebec and from Nova Scotia, among other places. Unlike many of the other musical genres, traditional dance music has not been scooped up and transformed into a commercially marketed corporate product. It survives and thrives via 21st century version of the oral tradition, directly from the practitioner to practitioner. My connection to this music and dance tradition is both as a casual band member and a caller of local dances. So, Richard, there's somebody, Chip, who says, yeah, the music is intertwined with the dancing, and you'd agree.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't dance, really, without music, although some of the Western square dancers dance basically without music.
Hmm.
That's what Hot Hash is.
Hot Good. Hash I was going to ask you to explain the title of the book, American Country Dancing from Hornpipes to Hot Hash.
Exactly. Hot Hash is a kind of calling that sounds like an auctioneer who you can't understand. He's talking to somebody like that. That's what it is. And it's like military movement. There is no music to it. So to me, that's not dancing. It's drill. But it's, you know, there's a legitimate number of people that do it and they enjoy it. And who am I to knock it? It's not for me.
Yeah.
To me, it's the music. And the amazing thing is I've been involved in this for almost 50 years now. And the music just seems to get better. It evolves depending on the kind of crowd that there is, which is a lot younger now. You know, the average dancer is probably my grandchildren's age. But it's exciting. It's incredibly exciting. It's better than ever, I think.
Dana, can you tell me a little bit about the interaction between the caller and the musicians and how then the dancers, the caller, and the musicians are all sort of working together?
Yes. It's definitely one of the important roles of the caller to not just direct the flow of the dancers, but to communicate with the band and figure out what is the best music that will go with the dance card. So before I start a dance, I'll show my dance card that has all the moves on it to the band, and I'll say, well, here's where the balance is, here's where the swings are, this bit has the long lines. And sometimes I'll have an idea as a caller of like, ooh, this would be a really good sort of like slinky, flowy dance, or this is a dance that has a lot of like stomping, marching, high energy. And then I really turn it over to the band, and good bands have so many sets up their sleeve and really have a good sense of dancing and of dances. I think a lot of musicians are also dancers, as many of us callers are also dancers. So I think a lot of bands, you can just sort of hand the dance over to them and say, here's the dance, here's what I'm thinking, but you pick something that feels good. And so then they do. And when the dance and the music matches, there's extra joy. It's extra good.
So how did you get into calling? Because I imagine this as sort of like the difference between being somebody who plays the crossword puzzle versus somebody who makes the crossword puzzle. I mean, it is really hard to make a good crossword. Is it really hard to be a good caller?
Yeah, it's hard to be really, really good at anything, right? And so I got into calling partly because I just like learning, doing new things. And I was interested in what the view would be from up on the stage and what the experience would be of the dance hall from the other side of things. I also got into calling just because I wanted more practice up behind a microphone, and I wanted to be able to get up and talk ad lib in front of a bunch of people and not completely lose my brain. And it's a really warm and welcoming community to practice that sort of public speaking facilitation organization in. And so that's been really valuable.
What, public radio hosting wasn't the first choice for you, Dana?
Yeah. I was like, and then they're calling me to be on the radio. It's obviously working. Caller success.
Let's hear from somebody else who appreciates this kind of music and dance. Carolina is calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Carolina. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I came to Contra Dance back in the early 1970s. Maybe Richard Neville, I think his name seems to ring a bell for me. Anyways, I don't remember who invited me, but we went to a dance in Nelson, New Hampshire. I guess it all began from there. And back then it was Ralph Page, I think, was still calling, and Newt Tolman. But Dudley Loffman back in the 70s was sort of the key caller. Like they called him the Pied Piper of contradance. And he, every Friday and Saturday around New England, he had a contradance. And some of us religiously followed him around because we got bitten by the bug. And I met a lot of people from Boston at that time, because at that time there was not live music in Boston. They came up here to hear the live music. And those were the early days of bands like Swallowtail in Massachusetts and Wild Asparagus. And the bug was just percolating all over. And even Duke Miller, who came over from New York, who brought singing squares, ended up with a following over here among the contra dancers in the summer. It was just quite a time. And some of those people from that time are still involved now. Andy Davis still calls family dances here in Brattleboro, and he was around back then, and many, many more. I have fond memories of that time, and it was a huge social component of a lot of our lives back
then.
Well,
Carolina, thank you for sharing. And these names that you're spouting off, you know, Richard is nodding. You know them all. And Richard, you weren't kidding when you said some of these people are legends and known throughout the region for their calling or for their music or, you know, for their influence on the scene.
Yeah, Carolina is talking about what I refer to as the golden age of contradancing. Dudley was the guy.
Is that just because that was your golden age?
No, it was because something magical was happening. My partner and I got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to make a film about it in 1976, which is how I got into doing research of the history. But more importantly, I don't know if the film had anything to do with spreading the word, but now you could go to a contra dance, I guarantee you, in all 50 states. Almost in any big town has one. If you go to Denmark, Holland, England, Scotland, you can go to a contra dance. It's huge, and it's everywhere. And it's spread because it is – it's the activity, I think, in socially that – it's more democratic than anything there else there is. You've got every age. You have every economic background. There are no restrictions on who can do it. And I think that's very special.
Dana, do you agree? Do you think this is really a democratic kind of dance? And are there really people of all ages and all demographics at these dances?
Yeah, absolutely. I was like, ooh, let me follow on what Richard said about democratic. I think my word was egalitarian, but very, very similar. Yes, contra dancing has everybody at it. There are some tiny babies strapped to their parents. There's grandparents. There's retired folks. There's young professionals. There's a bunch of teenagers. There's really a lot of generations, and also a lot of folks from a different walks of life. I think people tend to think of contra dancing as a sort of place for hippies, counterculture folks, revolutionary, that kind of thing. But certainly we have those folks, but we also have old Vermont farmers, and we have, like I said, those young professionals. We have men who wear skirts. We have women who wear skirts. We have women who don't shave their body hair. We have other women who do shave and wear makeup. Like, it's really a grand gamut of humanity.
When you think about the couples in the dance, Dana, is there a typical sort of gender dynamic to that that can either be followed or transgressed, or does it matter whether what gender the couples are and how that all works?
Yeah, so your gender presentation and your gender identity has nothing to do with your dance role. Anybody can do either role. And that is a shift and a sort of revolution that's been happening, I would say, in the last 10 years or so of contra dancing. It used to be more along gender lines. So the roles are traditionally called gents and ladies. Some callers will even say men and women. But it's becoming more and more apparent that men are dancing the ladies' role, and ladies are dancing the men's role, and genderqueer people are dancing everything. So we're really in the middle of a shift in the contra community around gender and around language, and shifting the terminology Some dances are starting to go with gender-neutral terms, using larks and ravens instead of gents and ladies. And I think this is really a model of the way we can be inclusive of a lot of different genders and of people dancing whatever role they like. I mean, I started out dancing the traditional ladies' role, learned how to dance the gents' role, the other role, just so I could dance with my friends. I came to dancing with a bunch of female friends. And now I find that dancing both roles just makes me a better dancer and allows me to have twice the fun and interact with twice the people. So I'm really glad to see this shift in the gender, the gender world and the language around dancing. And it's definitely still very much in progress and in conversation in our communities.
We got a note from KT in Sexton's River who says, I wouldn't be here in Vermont if it weren't for country dancing. I was living in Northampton in 1992 and met a woman from Westminster West at a country dance. She would drive down and attend the dances, which were held frequently. We hit it off, and I ended up moving in with her in 1993. When our relationship ended 6 years later, I was absolutely hooked on Vermont. After renting for a few years in Sexton's River, I bought my own house, and I can't imagine living anywhere else. And all of this thanks to country dancing. And let's go to Ken, who's calling in from Pittsford. Hi, Ken. Go right ahead.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm Ken from Pittsford, and I first started contra dancing back, in 79, which was right out of college. And at first wasn't familiar, but within a few dances became hooked by the bug. And that's been pretty near 40 years ago. And I really feel it's been one of the joys of my life to be able to enjoy the dances, and would highly recommend it for people in all walks and ages and families. It's a great experience for families to join in, because your age and your ability doesn't really matter. And it's all about enjoying. It's actually a very community experience, I've found, and highly recommend it, and would love to get that out to people who would feel a little bit nervous about trying this. Don't be afraid. People help. Experienced couples will be more than glad to help you if you're feeling a little lost. That's part of the fun.
Ken, thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate you and the gentle push that you have for people who might want to try it. Let's get another call in here from Irv in Norwich. Hi, Irv. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to say that my wife and I met through contra dancing, and we've been married 30 years at the end of this month.
Congratulations.
It's a great way to meet people. It's a great way to relax. It's really high-energy exercise. It's the most enjoyable form of exercise I know. And the other thing I'd say, if you're trying it, if you come with somebody else who's never done it either, don't cling to each other. Accept invitations to dance from more experienced people who will help you learn.
That's a great idea, Irv. Thanks, and congratulations on 30 years of contra dancing with your spouse. We're talking about contra and other forms of American country dancing today with Richard Neville. His book is called A Time to Dance, American Country Dancing from Hornpipes to Hot Hash. And thanks to Richard, we now know what hot hash is. We're also talking today with contra dancer, organizer, and caller Dana Dwinell-Yardley. Richard, we heard from some callers earlier who were really extolling the virtues of contra dancing, not just for social reasons, but also for health reasons.
Right. Yeah. About a year ago, the New York Times published an article by their health person, Gretchen Reynolds. And the gist of the article was about a study done at the University of Illinois on the benefits of exercise for aging people who are getting into issues of, forgetfulness and what am I trying to say?
Dementia. Yep.
Dementia, that kind of thing. And they did a study, a real study of three kinds. One is sort of yoga type, very laid back, that kind of thing. And then they did aerobic exercise, jogging, And the third one was contra dancing. And this was to measure which activity actually helped the white brain cells, which is what happens, they die. Contra dancing won, hands down, not even close. much better because it has a spiritual quality to it. It has music. It has everything.
Yeah, it has physicality and memory. You have to remember the
and
steps.
And memory.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
You know, it's starting to sound a little bit too utopian for my likes here, Richard and Dana.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about people of all ages, all social demographics, socioeconomic status, no matter what your gender presentation. It can now prevent Alzheimer's. Dana, is it, I mean, some reality check here. It can't be all that, really?
Yeah. We, contradancers, definitely, we like to believe in the utopia, and that's what keeps us coming back, right? But it's definitely not perfect by any means. I would say in terms of the generations, we are missing the generation that starts in the, like, mid to late 30s up through 50. People start having kids. They start creating families, young professionals. People are tired on a Friday night or Saturday night. 8 o'clock at night is not a great time for people with young children to come out and do a social activity. So I think we could do more to make a welcoming dance space for that generation of folks.
You know, you can also imagine that this has the hashtag stuff white people like attached to it. Is there a racial,
yes,
you know, racial dynamic here?
Yes, we are definitely a very white activity. There is that aspect of it, and that is a piece that we talk about in New England dance for sure. This is definitely a stuff white people like space, and that's also a conversation that comes up. Traditional New England folk dancing, you don't think of folks of color.
Richard, jump in.
I just want to jump in for a second and say it's true, but it's not for bad reasons. It's because the music, which I think is still the key component, it's very white music. It's coming from North, Scotland, Ireland, Northern France, where there was not an African-American component. So I think it's just natural, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I think they would be welcome if they came, absolutely.
Dana, go ahead.
I will add as a counterpoint to that, though, that I have heard that a lot of the square dancing traditions was very strong in the African-American culture, and certainly some of the Appalachian music is definitely influenced by African-American culture as well. So I think we do have a little bit of a whitewashing thing that goes on as white people say, oh, well, this is just a white people thing. But there are some influences from African-American tradition that makes its way into Contra in a sort of maybe less than visible way, but it is there.
Oh, for sure. I get into it in the book, but in the old days, when slavery was still here, the slave owners used their fiddlers. They used their slaves to be fiddlers in contests against other slaves. It was, you know, not nice.
Well, and you're getting into some of the history, Richard, which I teased at the beginning as sort of a wild history of what people may not expect to be sort of this long history of twists and turns. And maybe you can highlight a few moments like that. I mean, that's taking us back to the 16 and 1700s. And these dances do go back several hundred years and have, of course, as anything that's that long would, some wild moments and twists and turns.
Yeah, well, the contra dancing or line dancing, whatever you want to call it, went figure dancing. It's all dependent on the music, what the music is. And the English style is pretty sedate because the English music is pretty sedate. Whereas if you go to Ireland or Scotland or even better, Quebec, you get really fast-moving, very energetic music. And if you go up to Cape Breton in Nova Scotia, you get the same kind of very intense, a little bit ragged, but very, very infectious music. And in Cape Breton, they actually stopped using collars because they decided they just wanted to hear the music and they didn't need somebody telling them what to do. They could make up the dance as they go along. So that's what they do. And it's quite wonderful, actually.
Can you
no offense to the caller here.
Can you also share the moment that Henry Ford actually got in the mix here?
Oh, boy. Yeah, Henry Ford. Well, that was controversial.
Yeah.
I mean, it is now. He didn't think it was. But, yeah, he didn't like jazz. He didn't like Jewish. He didn't like, you know, almost everything except very waspy stuff. So he adopted contra dancing and
as a way to turn people away from the popular jazz movement.
Trying to get people away. And I guess it worked to a certain extent. But I'll say one thing. There's a group from Vermont called the Ed Larkin Dancers, and they were formed in the 30s. And they at one point competed against Henry Ford's demonstration group from Dearborn or wherever it was, Greenfield Village or something. And the Larkin people beat them hands down, no problem.
Well, one would expect no less from Vermonters.
Of course.
Let's go to Odin, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Odin. You're on.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to say, earlier in the show, people were talking about the infectious joy that this can generate. And there's a thing called entrainment, where people moving together with other people, it develops a certain special quality in all the people. And the thing is, in the old days, there used to be more of this in our lives. Like if people in the old days were harvesting a large grain field, you'd have maybe 20 people swinging scythes, and they had to be in rhythm with each other or somebody would cut somebody. And some of these kind of dances were, you know, that commuter helped the community to develop rhythm in the community in a safe way. But the thing is, in modern life, where else do we operate in rhythm with a whole community? Right here is one of the only places in modern life where that happens, and I think that's part of why it generates that special joy. I think human beings are designed to function that way, and in modern life, there's very little of it.
Odin, I love that theory, you know, this idea that it's people sort of moving in unison, moving in rhythm together and getting that opportunity that we don't get so much elsewhere. Let me read some notes from listeners that are coming in here. Gabrielle says, I'm a regular contra dancer, and one of my favorite things about contra dancing is how experienced dancers develop their own style within the dances. I'm a fairly energetic and big dancer. I like to stomp my feet and add in spins whenever I can. But you also have dancers who are incredibly graceful and smooth. It's a delightful mix of community. Margaret from Middlebury says, an acquaintance invited me to my first contra dance 9 years ago. I fell in love. The music and the focus on moving in time with a room packed with people were enchanting. Many dances later, we've been happily married for 7 years. This is like, you know, Tinder for dancers, Tinder for people who want to do contra dancing. Apparently, it's just a social event here. Everybody's getting married at contra dances. And Heidi from Burlington says, my 15-year-old daughter and her friends just attended the contra dance in Burlington last Friday night and said it was the best night out they had had in a long time. So there we go, for all ages. And let's go to Pete, who's calling in from Barnet. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I feel like I'm playing one-upsmanship here, but I just wanted to say that I think that contra dancing literally saved my life. And I mean that. Long ago, when I first discovered contra dancing, at the same time I began an extremely bitter child custody fight. In the courts, it lasted over 2 years, and it was contra dancing that allowed me to endure that. I think maybe I would have turned to drugs or alcohol otherwise. And I really think that the contra dancing is what saved me. I danced my way through the whole thing, and I'm here to tell about it today. So it's I have very, very fond memories.
Fond memories? You're not still dancing, Pete?
I'm sorry, what?
Fond memories? Are you not still dancing?
Oh, yes. I don't dance as much, partly because I broke my foot a few years ago. But, no, I still dance, not quite as much. And sometimes, your guest talked about the golden age of contra dancing. That's when I was doing it. And sometimes I think, I don't know if the magic is still there. It sort of is. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah, Pete, I really appreciate your story, and I'm glad that contra dancing saved your life. You should write a book. That's a great title for your next book. Dana, I mean, lots of people here saying contra dancing has played a really big role in their lives. You're a young dancer, a young caller. Is this something that you think you'll continue on with through your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say I resonated with what Pete said. Contra dance got me through some breakups for sure. It's a way to have human touch that's in a structured, safe way for 10 minutes at a time. But in bigger than that, it really, Contra Dance is a huge majority of my friends and my community and my social circles are built on this foundation of the dance community. It is an amazing place to build these larger networks of folks. Many of the folks I'm friends with now, we don't necessarily always dance all the time, but those relationships that I've made through dance, I now play board games with those folks or go hiking or organize weekend events. And you can, anywhere you go dancing, you'll probably find someone who knows someone who knows someone else. So these communities are very interwoven in this lovely way. And yeah, it's a community that you'll carry, I hope I'll carry with me through my whole life. And these older dancers and the older leadership definitely is an inspiration to me that they're still finding that community, even though folks who may be 20, 30, 40 years older than me. So well, yay, contra dancing forever.
Contra dancing forever and contra dancing for everyone. That's Dana Dwinell Yardley, a contra dancer, dance organizer, and caller who lives in Montpelier. We've also been talking with Richard Neville, a New Hampshire author, filmmaker, and contra dance enthusiast. His book, recently reissued, A Time to Dance, American Country Dancing from Hornpipes to Hot Hash, and he splits his time between New Hampshire and Bali. Richard and Dana, thanks very much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.